Father, we thank you for the air conditioning coming in and looking to your word. Thank you for just all the comforts and the blessings that you put into our life. And just pray, Lord, as we look into your word, that you would just cultivate faithfulness, cultivate love for you as we seek to know you better. Christ in your grace, amen. Okay, well, we are in 1 Samuel chapter 18. And,
note here. I usually skip over this part, so we're going to...
David and Saul, really the only appearance of Samuel at this point is the only time he speaks is from the dead. And then also we have a mention of his death in a later chapter as well. But here we begin this saga between David and Saul, where really chapter 21, he begins his flight from Saul, and that continues all the way through the end of the book. But in this passage, in this portion right here, 18 through 21, there's a lot of interactions between the two and a lot of interactions between David and the household of Saul. Everybody loves David, everybody except for Saul. Saul is seen to be the only one here who cannot see David's worth. So let's go ahead and dive in here. We began the contrast with Saul last time when there was some interaction between them just before the battle with Goliath. And that contrast continues in our chapter today. Any questions or thoughts before we begin tonight? Okay, well, let's look at verses 1 through 4. Who would like to read those for us? Yes, Anita. Okay, thank you. It begins with, "Now it came about when he had finished speaking with Saul." So this is immediately following the confrontation with Goliath. David has presented Goliath's head before Saul, and there's been some interaction there. So this is on that same occasion. Now, at points, the author can be a little confusing because he seems to kind of step into the future and look well past the present. But then at other times, I mean, he'll just do that for a moment, and then he'll step back into the chronology here that's consistent. And so just bear that in mind as we read this here. In verse 1, it says, twice we see here that Jonathan is said to love David. Jonathan loved him as himself, and it says because he loved him as himself. It's interesting here, two different words are used there. Let's see here. Where's the first one? There it is. Yeah, it is in verse 1. Okay. So in verse 1 and verse 3, we have these statements. Two different words are used there, but they're actually related words. One word is the root word for the other. And we see in this context that they're used synonymously. And one of these words is used in chapter 16, verse 21, as far as getting a feel for what does this word mean. Then David came to Saul and attended him, and Saul loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. We also see the word used later in our present chapter, chapter 18, but all Israel and Judah loved David, and he went out and came in before them. The reason I draw attention to these words is, I want to show you that the term love is, in this context, is somewhat elastic, is very broad application, as we've seen from these instances. It'd be very similar to our own word for love. I could say... I love Janet, and I could say, I love barbecue, and I could also say, I love that guy, you could use it in many different ways, and it's not necessarily signifying something sexual, which some have interpreted this as being sexual, some sort of sexual love between David and Jonathan. The key verse here, I mean, we're just getting an introduction here, but I wanted to address it tonight since we encountered this language. The key verse here comes in 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 26. Oh, I'm sorry. That's the wrong one. Did I not have that right? Oh. Okay, well, if you like, I could just read it for you. You could turn there. But in chapter 1, verse 26, it says, I am distressed. This is after David learns of Jonathan's death. Okay, the Amalekite has come and reported his death, and David breaks into song a dirge, really, for Jonathan. And he says, I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. So they really capitalize on that verse and say, ah, see, this is better than the love of women. This obviously must have been some sort of homosexual relationship. It's interesting when we look at the scriptures, and I guess maybe I already put this up here. This is something that's perhaps lost in a context where homosexuality is on the rise. But it is, in non-homosexual contexts, it's not uncommon for there to be a very close relationship between men. It says, if your brother, your mother's son, or your son or daughter, or the wife you cherish, or your friend who is as your own soul. I think that's the kind of relationship we're talking about here. Clearly a differentiation between the wife you cherish and your friend who is as your own soul, the description there. I would also say here that my personal opinion is that this could be viewed as a commentary on polygamy, okay? If you think about it, polygamy would not foster a very close relationship between a husband and a wife, pure and simple. And so I could see why David would speak that way, that in some ways, as far as a close relationship, a friendship that grew in depth, Jonathan was that relationship. And really, we see a kindred spirit. We've seen earlier where Jonathan is a man of faith. Now we see David appear on the scene as a man of faith. We see similar instances in the New Testament. Let's see. Oh, I did not put that up there either. There it is. Okay. For I have no one else. This is Paul speaking of Timothy. For I have no one else of kindred spirit who will genuinely be concerned for your welfare, for they all seek after their own interests, not those of Christ Jesus. But you know his proven worth, that he served me with in the furtherance of the gospel like a child serving his father. So just a very kindred spirit there, very like-mindedness between Paul and Timothy. That's the level of relationship that I would view this as. And the relationship we see is sealed in covenant. It's sealed with a covenant. The terms are not stated here. They actually enter into another covenant, perhaps in addition to this one later on, that was perhaps more binding. And again, it's just a tangible way of them expressing their commitment to one another. Certainly mutual concern would have been part of this. And this mutual concern is also manifested in Jonathan equipping David with his personal armor and weapons. Okay. Now, it's interesting, David rejected Saul's weapons, but now he accepts Jonathan's. Why? What's the difference? It's a little smaller, fit better. Say again? Different relationship? Okay. And there was a motivation, there was an intent there with rejecting Saul's armor. When he faced Goliath, he wanted to be showing them that this was the Lord that was doing this. So yeah, at this point, again, I mentioned it Sunday night, and at this point, I mean, David does adopt armor. David at one time does carry Goliath's sword, so we're not to think that David always went into, battle with a sling and that's it. That was a specially tailored occasion there. Well, this bond only became stronger over time. Again, we'll get to it later in chapter 23 where they utter a very a good commitment there. Jonathan realizes that David will one day be king and he'll be at his side, he says. At least that was his intent. He died before that could take place. But at any rate, any questions or thoughts there before we move on? Yes. I think just no more than the armor or anything else. I think he's bestowing honor upon him. Here's my armor. As far as royalty, are you thinking? Something along those lines? Perhaps at this point, I mean, there's nothing expressed that says that Jonathan knew that he was going to be the next king. We definitely see that later. Jonathan knows and he accepts that David's going to be the next king, even though Jonathan's heir to the throne. Okay, anyone else? Okay. Who would like to read for us verses 5 through 9? Yes.
So David went out wherever Saul sent him and behaved wisely. Saul sent him with men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Now it happened, as they were coming home, when David was hurrying from the slaughter of the Philistines, women had come out of all the cities of Israel, dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines of joy and music. So the women sang as they danced and said, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000." And Saul was very angry, saying displeasingly, he said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000 and to me they have ascribed only 1,000. Now what more can he have of the kingdom?" So I, David, met a forward.
Okay, thank you. Verse 5, presumably, I mean, this may be looking past the present, or it may be that immediately following the defeat of Goliath, David is given this position. And actually, this position of being over the men of war, it seems that he set them over all, and he actually receives a demotion later, as he is only set over 1,000. He tries to put him in a more vulnerable position where he would be in the front line. But Let's see. He says, when David returned from killing the Philistines. So again, we're back on that occasion very early in this interaction between the two men. The women celebrate the victory in song. Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Now, clearly hyperbole is being applied here, because at this point, the only person that's been expressly slain is Goliath, okay? It's doubtful that David has killed 10,000 in his first day on the job. But again, the distinction that's being made here is what's important. They assign greater honor to David, and for good reason. You have to remember that at this point, Saul has been a disappointment. At this point, I think everybody's seen that it's like, we asked for a man to go out before us to fight our battles. He wasn't that man. David now is. It says, then Saul became very angry. Why? Why would he become very angry? Jealousy, envy. Okay, that's kind of the underlying reality here. He's getting more of the glory here of battle. He wanted David to slay the giant, but he wanted to receive the glory. Isn't that interesting? He wanted to get the credit. He wanted the pat on the back, and yet at the same time, he didn't want to face the giant. His insecurity is for good reason. He says there, now what more can he have but the kingdom? And this fits very well with what we read earlier in chapter 15, verse 28. So Samuel said to him, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you." Now, all of a sudden, he encounters a guy who's better than him, and it's unnerving. This, again, flings him into this suspicious state. Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. So from the very first day, he is suspicious with David till the very end. He's always chasing after David and trying to eliminate him. Any questions or thoughts there through verse 9? Yes. Okay, Vince, and then we'll come back to Mac. Okay. We don't know how many, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. Right. And Saul's sitting in the background. Okay. Right. Anyone else? Right. And that's where he gets confusing. It's where he seems to look past But clearly this statement that's made by the women is as they're coming back from slaying the Philistine. So you end up with this mixed perspective. Oh, I see. Well, what does it say there? I think it says the Philistine. When David returned from killing the Philistine. What verse was that? Verse 6. Yeah, when David came back from returned from killing the Philistine, the women came out of all the cities of Israel. So again, that's what it's one of the challenges of reading 1 and 2 Samuel is, you know, sometimes the author, he just kind of skips ahead, and for whatever reason, you know, at any rate. Any other questions or thoughts? Okay. Who would like to read verses 10 through 13 for us? Oh, Vince. 18. Yeah, chapter 18, verse 10. 10 through 13. Yeah, that's where the 13 came from. Okay, did I mishear you or something? It's chapter 18, verses 10 through 13. Okay, thank you. So here we are on the next day, okay? On the next day, so he is giving us some time markers here. An evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house. This word raved, it's interesting. I mean, the New American Standard translators, they felt uncomfortable translating it literally, so they said raved. But the word literally is prophesy, okay? That's what it is. In fact, I pointed this out earlier, but we can look at it again. Back in chapter 10, verse 6, it says, "Then the Spirit of the Lord will come mightily upon you mightily, and you shall prophesy with them and be changed into another man." So similar formula is used concerning the coming of the Spirit and then the coming of this evil spirit. And it's interesting that language of coming upon you mightily and you shall prophesy. Clearly, the prophecies stirred up by an evil spirit are not those, you know, similar to those of the Holy Spirit, but there still is this sense in which they weren't coming from Saul, okay? And so they were supernaturally inspired, you might say. They were of demonic origin. They weren't coming from Saul. And so in that sense, there's a parallel. That's why the language of prophesying is used. And of course, the whole idea of being changed into another man. We do see Saul changed into another man. He's turned into a murderer, okay? Before, he was changed into the king of Israel, someone who would be competent in that position. Now we see him chasing after the next king, trying to murder him. Here's David, dutifully playing the harp for Saul's benefit, and Saul is walking around thinking of somehow he could harpoon him, okay? He tries this on more than one occasion and does not succeed. Again, we see that the music is no longer effective, okay? We're not told why it was effective in the first place, and we're not told why it's not effective now, but it's not. Now, what would Saul have told? I mean, here's David. David has fame already. His name is a household name in Israel. And what would Saul have told the nation had he succeeded? "I just slayed the champion." Yeah, whoops. This is probably what motivated. I mean, Saul in his saner moments, in his moments of clarity, is probably looking at this saying, you know, I can't kill David this way. If I end up killing David, that's going to be very bad for me politically. I lose the confidence of the people and so forth. And so in a moment of clarity, he sees what he's doing and puts David out of his presence, okay? And he seeks to kill him in a more subtle way, a clever way, so that he wouldn't be the one who is actually doing it. He makes him a commander of 1,000, okay? Again, this would seem to be a demotion, and it would put him more in harm's way. Okay, he'll put more in harm's way. Any questions or thoughts there through verse 13? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even as a young man, I mean, he was a unique individual from the word go here. And, you know, just think about what you as David. I'm sure he probably blamed it on the evil spirit. I'm sure he rationalized it. Because as we go on in the chapter here, he's really quite unsuspecting. He doesn't suspect Saul of anything. He seems to have blamed, you know, these attempts on his life on the spirit, not on Saul himself. But at any rate, he feels compelled to hang around at this point. Anyone else? Yes, Ian. Yeah, I would take that as a demon. Yeah, I say that again. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's Lord of all, even the demons, you know, he commands the demons, so that's right. Anyone else? Okay. Who would like to read verses 14 through 19 for us? Scott. Thank you. It says, David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. That's very important here, because it's easy to maybe characterize this as a struggle between Saul and David. And yet you have to remember that David is the Lord's anointed. So all throughout here, the Lord is preserving David. He is ultimately watching over him and protecting him. It says, when Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. Okay, so Saul is experiencing a spectrum of emotions here. He's very angry, he's dreading him, he's attempting to kill him. This I would really see, yes, he's being tormented by this evil spirit, but it's really also a hallmark of faithlessness. Here's a man who is basically left to his own resources, okay? He's not trusting God. And so he's just experiencing all the ups and downs of what you experience when you're trusting in your own resources here. And he's clearly evil at this point. He begins scheming. The details of the arrangement aren't given here. It would seem that he was to accomplish something against the Philistines that isn't described. More details given later on the second offer there. But he wants his hand to be against the Philistines, or I'm sorry, yes, it has something to do with the Philistines, presumably defeating them in some way in order to have his older daughter's hand. And it's interesting, what is David's response to this? Who am I? Yeah, now that's interesting, because defeating Goliath was no small feat. And here he is, the women are singing, Saul has, you know, slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. So clearly he's been experiencing some praise here for this great feat. And yet we see that his attitude is still very much humble. Now contrast Saul. After Saul experiences a little bit of success, what do we see him do? What's that? Okay, yeah, he's raising a monument to himself. He's putting everybody under a vow until he's avenged of his enemies. It becomes a very self-oriented rulership here. And so David hasn't been characterized by that, even though he has been accorded tremendous praise. I enjoyed Wiersbe here. Wiersbe says, faith is living without scheming. And we see here that Saul is the faithless man. He's scheming. He's coming up with his own devices. And David is just doing what, you know, is right and following the Lord. It's interesting. Later he would write, Psalm 26, verse 9 says, do not take my soul away along with sinners, nor my life with men of bloodshed, in whose hands is a wicked scheme and whose right hand is full of bribes. But as for me, I shall walk in my integrity and redeem me and be gracious to me. That's the words of faith. That is the heart of faith. It says, okay, all these people are out here. My enemies are creating these devices. They're trying to trip me up and get me in some way, kill him ultimately. And yet he says, I will walk in my integrity. That's his strength. His strength is in the Lord. A very good example of what it means to walk by faith. Not to respond in kind. Later, he would write this. We don't really know the timing of these two psalms, but we have Psalm 37 here. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who carries out wicked schemes. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It leads only to evil doing. Isn't that what we see in Saul, right? For evildoers will be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord, they will inherit the land. Yet a little while, and the wicked man will be no more, and you will look carefully for his place, and he will not be there. But the humble will inherit the land, and will delight themselves in abundant prosperity. The wicked plots against the righteous and gnashes at him with his teeth. The Lord laughs at him, for he sees his day is coming. Boy, David becomes, you know, the preeminent, you might say, Old Testament example of faith here, where here he is, Saul is chasing after him, and yet he's trusting the Lord, my hand shall not be against him, and what? The Lord's laughing in heaven. He sees that the wicked's day is coming, and Saul's day does come, and he does in his own time take him out. The irony of Saul trying to set up this demise by the Philistines is that he says, let the hand of the Philistines be against him. David gets to the point where he's actually dwelling in the land of the Philistines. He's dwelling in the lion's den, if you will, living among the Philistines, and he's still not harmed by them. He's preserved by God. And yet, the very group that Saul tries to kill David, gets to kill David, is the group that kills Saul. Saul will die at the hand of the Philistines. Let's see here. Any other questions or thoughts there? It's interesting, just a footnote here, speaking to, what was her name again? The eldest daughter? Mirab. She is actually given to, the individual she's given to, Adriel, the Mahalathite, for a wife, produces five sons. And at the end of the day, Saul ends up breaking the treaty with the Gibeonites. He ends up slaughtering the Gibeonites, trying to, you remember the Gibeonites made a pact with Joshua, and there was a vow there and so forth. The nation was bound to protect them and not kill them. But we see later in 2 Samuel 21 that Saul does kill them. He breaks that vow, and so God sends a drought upon the land. And part of the atoning process is the five sons of the daughter here are killed. They're put to death to atone for that. Okay, any other questions or thoughts? verses 20 through 25. Who would like to read those? Yes, Tom. Oh, okay. It's a question. Mm-hmm. That's a good question, because God does honor it. That was the Gibeonites' request. And remember, they were the ones who were, the debt was to them because Saul slaughtered them. He broke the covenant. And so that was their demand. They said, give us some of the sons of Saul, and so they could put him to death. But the Lord responded to it. I mean, it's, you know, the drought is lifted as a result of that. So, okay, 20 through 25. Who would like to read those? Yes.
And I will swear to him that she may be a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Saul commanded his servants, and all his servants loved him. Now therefore,
okay, thank you. Michael, Saul's daughter, she is said to love David. She loved David. Michael, by the way, is a feminized version of the masculine Michael, like the archangel. Okay, so that's where that name comes from. This is, by the way, the only passage in the Bible outside of a particular book that we are told that a woman loves a man. Anybody know what book that might be that is the other place? Song of Solomon. That's the only other place. Kind of interesting. I never realized that before, but some of the commentators were bringing that out, that this is the only place outside of that book where we read of this. And he says, I will give her to him that she may become a snare to him. What's that? He knew her well. It's kind of interesting because I think initially he didn't anticipate getting that far. I think she was the bait. I mean, she was the bait and the trap were the Philistines. And so, you know, it wasn't necessarily a reflection upon her character. Not necessarily. She is a snare in the sense that she's the bait in the snare. And the Philistines were the real ones that he was anticipating would kill him. Saul commanded his servants, speak to David secretly. Now, we've discussed secrecy in the past, okay, in dealing with this. Samuel, when he is going to anoint David, he employs secrecy, okay, to bring that to pass. And, you know, is this the good kind of secrecy? Is this noble secrecy? We would say Samuel's was, but not this. Why? Okay, I hear a lot of mumbling. Come on now, speak up. Okay. Yes, the whole thing is ignoble here, okay? And it comes back to the intent. Samuel is going to do what the Lord has commanded him, go anoint David, okay? And on the other hand, there is no such command here. This is totally Saul and his conniving, okay? So this is evil designs. Now, what advantage is there in having others tell David? Why doesn't he just call him and say, hey, David, you know? Okay, he's a lousy actor? Okay. Sure. Okay. Sure. Yeah. You know, there is something when you start hearing it from a bunch of different people. Okay. I also see here that, you know, Saul is using this to kind of get him to maybe speak freely. And it's kind of interesting how he uses David's response to now refine his scheme. Okay. What is David's problem? Why does he see himself as unworthy of becoming the king's son? Okay, he's poor, and what? Okay, I heard like five different things. He's poor, let me just say it here. He's poor, it says, and lightly esteemed. That idea of being lightly esteemed means, you know, he hasn't really proven himself, okay? He hasn't really proven himself. This is like he's entering into the royal family. Do I really have the status and worth to enter into the royal family? So, again, we're seeing the humility of David. And we're also seeing that now Saul refines his scheme and says, oh, okay, I will give him a means, a very specific means, of proving his worth. Okay, the king does not desire any dowry, except 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies. Okay, well, what? That's all. Yeah, that's all. And so this is, again, a very peculiar dowry here, to say the least. Not conventional by any stretch of the imagination. But this is what he now does, and this will indeed bring him into conflict with the Philistines. Okay, and it seems to be, you know, the implication is that, okay, you're going to go and do this, not with the army, but on your own. He takes his own personal men and then goes and accomplishes it. Any questions or thoughts? Yes, Joy. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, all these things, you're right, very good point. Yeah, he was Saul did not deliver on that promise. So he comes along and he adds more conditions. That's kind of the way, you know, again, Saul works there. Anyone else? Okay, well, let's press on here. We'll finish up. Verses 26 through 30, who would like to read those? Yes. Okay, thank you. When his servants told David these words, he said, "That's disgusting." That's not what it says, is it? It pleased David to become the king's son-in-law. Different age, obviously, right? Not exactly the response we're anticipating. You know, there wasn't any kind of, no thanks. He doesn't think anything of this. And so it's kind of interesting how, you know, again, something that to us would be repulsive. Are you really asking me to do this? Again, David doesn't think anything of it. In fact, it says there, David rose up and went, he and his men, and struck down 200 men among the Philistines. He accomplished this with zeal, okay? Not just meeting the minimum here, but he goes and doubles the dowry price from 100 to 200. And again, just the thought there. Anyway, he has his men. It says he and his men These men went, though they themselves weren't going to receive a bride. Okay, this is all for David. What does that say about these men? Somebody's loyalty. Yeah, that's right. And I would see them in the same caliber. I mean, really, in what they're going to do with David, I mean, I see them as the same caliber as Jonathan. Clearly, they have a commitment to him, a spiritual, there's a spiritual aspect to this where they are of a like faith here. They're very tight with David. And so when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, boy, he feared him greatly, it says there. And so he was even more afraid. Plan A had not worked, and plan B isn't going to work either. He's not going to be able to, he doesn't see himself at least, being able to manipulate Michal, and she does ultimately help David escape in a few chapters. So she is clearly in love with him at this point. That love does not last, mind you. Years later, Michal is very bitter about life, okay? She's very bitter about life. She ends up going and becoming, I think she finally sees she's a pawn. She goes and becomes the husband of another man. David brings her back and just reinforces his claim on the throne there. And so she resents David later on in life. But at this point, she is in love with him. Then Saul was even more afraid of David, it says. Thus, Saul was David's enemy continually. Now, that is totally irrational. The Lord is with you. So I'm going to be against you continually. Okay. That is complete irrationality. And again, there is no wisdom and no understanding and no counsel against the Lord. I love that proverb, and I bring it up frequently because it just points to the total irrationality of fighting the Lord, fighting against the Lord, trying to counter what he is ultimately planning and will accomplish. Any questions or thoughts there as we close tonight? Okay, well, let's go ahead and take some prayer requests then.